music is the theme song to Mad Men, which premiered its fourth season on Sunday night on AMC. Viewership up some 5% over last year's premiere, 61% over their average viewership last year. Just under 3 million people watched this show. Many people have become addicted to it, myself included. That's why when I heard about a new book called Mad Men Unbuttoned, I said, let's get the author on and talk about the show and, more importantly, the era that the show takes place in and everything that was going on at the time. Dr. Natasha Vargas Cooper is that author. She runs the Mad Men Unbuttoned website as well. She's written for the Daily Beast and the Huffington Post and worked for E! Online. Now she's the West Coast correspondent for The All. And Natasha, welcome to the Big 550 KTRS.
It's great to be here to share our addiction.
Yeah. First of all, impressions of season four, which got underway Sunday night.
Oh, that was dark. Which is good, because that was really the big question that's been left after three pretty, outstanding seasons was, are they going to be cool? Are the men of Sterling Cooper, is Don Draper going to be able to keep up with the really rapid cultural changes? And I think what's clear is that they're struggling, right? Not just financially, but that everyone's a little out of step. And you can see that in the way that they did the hard pitch to the new folks. They said you either are comfortable or dead or risky and rich.
Yep, that was the Jensen people who made the two-piece. Not a bikini, but a
right,
two-piece.
Right, and it's not underwear. It's a bathing suit in two pieces. But I think what you were seeing in this pitch room when Don, who generally keeps his cool, really lost it and, yelled at them and kicked them out, was that pressure is really on, right? To stay young, to stay relevant, and now with mass media and with, a consumer flood that's coming, or it really is starting, it's really sink or swim for these guys.
Yep. That consumerism really started, of course, in post-World War II America, and particularly in the 50s, as the baby boom was really taking off, and we're going to see the consequences of that later on in the 60s, and I hope that Matthew Weiner and the Mad Men people, are eventually going to show us, the Summer of Love in 67, its impact on these people in New York and, the Beatles and all the rest of that. But in 64, we were right there at the cusp of a cultural change, right?
That's right.
So how is the show starting to reflect that, if at all, or are they still stuck in their 50s mores?
Well, no, it's interesting because if you think about what the show was before, which is about like 57 to 63, you had these, just look-wise, right? You had these cool, aesthetics, streamlined, muted, and it was the twilight of the Eisenhower era. So, all of the kind of formal rules around dating are starting to get chipped away at, and, what you saw in the first episode was that real streamlined, muted coolness is gone. It's very, very bright in the new office, and even the TV executive is wearing kind of goofy purple pants. And Peggy is sitting on the desk sipping her scotch. Things are already starting to get loose. Now, I don't know if they will get loose enough to vibe with the Summer of Love and all of that. But the other thing you're seeing really is also with Betty. I don't know if you noticed, but Betty's hair was really big. She was wearing a lot of makeup. She's a divorced lady now. She's on her second marriage. And so just that image of freshness, of muted coolness, that's all getting chipped away at.
Yeah.
And it's not done in this glowful, yay, it's the 60s, we're going to break loose, but in a, that there's turmoil underneath this incredibly slick surface, that the furniture, the emotional furniture, is starting to fray.
Yeah, you can actually see in Peggy and Betty two sides of a similar, if not the same, coin.
Right.
In that Peggy may be kind of on that leading edge of what will later be called feminism.
Mm-hmm.
because she's the career woman who has great ideas and is really advancing and impressing some of the men and pushing her way through the crowd of men to make sure that she's heard. And on the other side of that coin, you've got Betty, who is this kind of stuck in the 50s housewife who, yes, she's left her man and started a new marriage, but is eventually, I think, going to be left behind, right?
I mean, that's what it's indicated as in, like, what we're seeing with Betty is that she may have just been a couple years. Well, actually, I would say that the biggest difference is that Peggy, well, they both have kids, but that Peggy doesn't have to raise her kids. And Peggy hasn't had to create a household. And so what that has done is that's allowed Peggy to just be more open to the zeitgeist and to the changing mores. And Betty's not. Betty is kept away in the suburbs. And I think she's experiencing the same restlessness that we see Peggy experiencing. But like you said, Peggy is maybe a prototypical feminist. Now, there's a trade-off there, which is that that's pretty advanced. So it may take a while for somebody like Peggy to find a guy that's into that. Right?
Yeah.
Like, we may see Peggy alone and single, or a career girl and a career girl first and only through that revolution.
As we saw with Rachel Menken, the woman who runs the department store
exactly,
that Don had the
right.
affair
Rachel
with.
Rachel said it's very lonely.
Yeah.
So I think what the creators of the show have done with those two women is given us a really brutalizing trade-off, which I think is accurate, which is... this is where the saying comes from, you know, you can't have it all. And especially for women at that time. And then in the 70s, the saying became, you could have it all. But they said that for a reason, which was up until then, it was either, you know, house, kids, and a calm domestic life, or a career girl. If you're a career girl, you can't have both.
Yeah. It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with Natasha Vargas Cooper about her book, Mad Men Unbuttoned, A Romp Through 1960s America. When we come back, we'll turn back towards the men, and in particular, Don Draper. She writes in the book about some of the real advertising men, some of the real Mad Men who created and changed advertising, both in print and in broadcast, in the 60s. We'll find out if Don Draper was really based on any of those when we come back with more of the John Brown Show with Paul Harris on the Big 550 KTRS. It's the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris talking with Dr. Natasha Vargas Cooper. Big fan of the TV show Mad Men. So much so that she's compiled a new book called Mad Men Unbuttoned, in which she looks at the styles, the culture, the fashions, and all the rest that made up the early 60s era that Mad Men takes place in. Let's talk about the leading man here, Don Draper, who, of course, is the creative director of the ad agency, Sterling Cooper Draper Price, as they now call it. You write in the book about several of the real-life Mad Men who in the 60s were influencing and perhaps even changing advertising. Mm-hmm. Is Don Draper based in particular on any one of those guys?
Yeah, I'd say that he, in corporeal form, is based on Draper Daniels, who shares a lot of the backstory that Don has. He was a farm boy from the Midwest, got into advertising just by accident. He was working at a car company, started writing some copy. Then he copied for their catalogs and then shot up through the ranks and was really at the table of the royal court of advertising. He worked at all the big advertising firms, and he is partly responsible for the Marlboro Man campaign. But where Draper Daniels did his work was under Leo Burnett. And I think, at least in philosophy, this is really the school that Don comes from. Because in advertising, especially at that time, while you, like you said, like while the consumer goods and the boom was happening right after the after World War II, advertising hadn't caught up yet. It only started to catch up in the 60s. And then you had the golden era of advertising. So during that time, Leo Burnett, his philosophy on selling ads was actually it's called branding now, was to make sure that the consumer had an emotional connection with the product. What that meant was not arguing the virtues of the product. It wasn't, this is why this tastes so good, or this is why this brand of cigarette is less, you know, cancerous than the other. For example, Leo Burnett, when one of his first most famous campaigns, it was like a throwaway campaign for the Meat Institute. And as opposed to saying, here are all the great things that you can have in red meat, he took us a big, thick slice of red meat, bloody, raw, put it against a bright red background, which you weren't supposed to do, and it just said, this is the life. Mm. So the idea was you create this connection, you speak in a language that the consumer speaks, and so they trust you and they trust your product. So what you see then is, like with Don, when he's talking about Lucky Strike, there's no need to make medical claims. There's no need to say anything beyond it's toasted. So that is who I would say he's based on, is Draper Daniels, who very much had a similar kind of uncanny successful career in advertising and worked with Leo Burnett. But overall, he has the Leo Burnett philosophy.
Do we have modern-day madmen who are changing the advertising industry with new media the way these guys did at the time with the then-new medium of television?
Well, you know, it's difficult to say because the market is so fractionalized, right? So, for example, you have the Old Spice commercials that came out about 2 weeks ago, and, I mean, everyone's been emailing them back and forth, right? But it's pretty difficult with that medium right now to have the same type of revolution and to have just the small cadre of men, because it really was about six guys. And even that the cover of Time, 1962, had them. It was like, these are the men who changed advertising, because they were the men behind the biggest firms. But even the biggest firms now are broken up into so many little pieces, into so many little niche markets. That, and just the way that media is structured and the way that we take in information now is so spread out that I don't know that you could do that again. I think that was a very particular moment, and I feel like we are, you know, the shots have been fired, the revolution happened, and the dust still hasn't quite settled in terms of how to make advertising so dynamic. I think actually people are still really, really scared and haven't quite figured out how to hone the medium.
It's interesting to me that you also in the book draw parallels between some of the characters on this fictional TV show to the real people who, of course, were alive and changing advertising at the time. And from there also to the fictional movie characters and the real-life actors who played them. You see a direct line between Don Draper and Cary Grant.
I do. Well, you know, I, as a woman, dear to my heart, is trying to figure out why every week when I look at John Hamm, I convulse because he's so attractive.
Same thing I have with Betty White.
And trying to figure out what are those elements, and I think that he, not only in look, but also in biography, shares a lot with Cary Grant. I mean, well, look at him. He has a lot of the same features. He's dark. He's brooding. I don't see John Hamm, who is the man who creates Don Draper, as a Brad Pitt. I see him more, his looks, his whole aura as a, you know, he's a 1940s star. And Cary Grant had this same kind of dark background. His mother was mentally ill. She killed herself in an institution much later in his life, but he basically wasn't raised with her. He was raised by a working-class father in England. He worked as an acrobat. His actual name was Archibald Leach. You know, so he has this kind of ugly past, and then he comes to America, and he completely reinvents himself. And one of the things that that people say, great film critics like Pauline Kael, said that what's always great about his performance is that there's Cary Grant, and then there's a little of the Archibald Leach. He was always able to somehow walk that that dark edge between being handsome yet ugly, brooding yet charismatic. So I really felt that there was a kind of a kinship there between the two.
All right. If you see that connection from Don Draper to Cary Grant, do you see a connection from Betty Draper? You know, Don would be the cool side of this. Do you see Betty Draper on the cold side of it with a link to perhaps the icy blondes of the Alfred Hitchcock movies?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's almost jarring how much she reminds me of Grace Kelly. And also in biography, fascinatingly enough, Grace Kelly had a similar kind of charmed life. She was, her and Betty supposedly studied right in the same area and were models. She also comes from the main line. She's a WASPy brat.
Mm-hmm.
But I think where they really parallel and what I think adds poignancy to the Betty Draper line is everyone, they say it in the show, oh, you look like Grace Kelly, is that Grace Kelly was married and she actually became a princess. It's literally a fairy tale to the Prince of Monaco and ended up becoming what's rumored to be a pretty significant alcoholic, suffered from severe depression, ended up moving into a separate palace away from the prince, and died in a car accident where she was speeding along the cliffs on the way to her house in Paris. So the point of drawing those two parallels, I think, is that there's a tremendous amount of tragedy in these people's lives. And I think Betty's life is very tragic. I don't feel pity for her, but I do feel like so much is out of her control, and she is so at the mercy of history.
I'll be honest with you. If a tragedy like that befell Betty Draper, that'd be great for me because I don't like the character anymore. And I hope that I hope that she's off the show after this season so that we can concentrate more on what's happening in the office and the changing mores of the time. But
yeah.
Maybe that's just me.
No, you know, Betty's not a very popular character. She's an ice queen, you know, but she's also probably the closest thing to a villain in Don's life. But, you know, Betty has those feelings because it's not like Don treated her with so much kindness and respect.
Now, one other change I've got to touch on here is a fashion change. And
mm-hmm.
You in Mad Men Unbuttoned, you write a lot about the styles and fashions of the early 60s and how they're going to be changing again soon. And on the cover, you got a silhouette, if you will, of a man in a suit carrying a briefcase. And he's wearing the one fashion accessory that I think was beginning to die in the end of 1964, just as the Beatles had taken over America earlier that year and youth was on the rise. I think the hat was dying out at around this time. Am I right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Men used to wear them to work all the time. They always had a hat rack in the office.
Yep.
That was gone soon, right?
Yeah, no, it used to. I mean, even just at that point, 20 years before then, it would be considered indecent. It would be like coming out in short pants if you went out in public and didn't have a hat with you.
Mm-hmm.
That is the end of that. And that has to do with, like you said, the Beatles. Also, just there is a full-on cultural rebellion and revolt and repulsion towards those Victorian caste system ideals of the previous era, of what I call the Eisenhower era. This is an opening up of the culture. What we're going to see is, I doubt Don will go this far, but I think the folks around him, I think we're going to start seeing the hair even getting a little bit longer, a little bit shaggier. And good Lord, I hope the show ends before there's leisure suits. But yes, it's amazing, though, and what I find so fascinating about the show, and this is why I wrote the book, is how fast that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are cultural tides, and things change, of course, and, you know, history is oftentimes a story of progress, but this is such an accelerated breakneck time, and that what's really fascinating about the show is how quickly the characters adapt to it and how quickly society around them adapts to it. Because what you're seeing, at least with Betty, is that Betty may have all these feelings and Betty may want to do all these things, but it's near impossible for her to do them right now. It was super hard to get divorced in New York. She still feels like she's reliant on a man, and that's still the dominant idea. So whereas Peggy, just a couple years younger, is plowing forward. So it's interesting to see in such a compressed time period how people get shaked out.
Absolutely right. The book and the website are both called Mad Men Unbuttoned, a romp through 1960s America. Natasha Vargas Cooper, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks so much.
Good luck with the book. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.